John 9, verse 1. As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus, "but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." After saying this, he spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. "Go," he told him, "wash in the pool of Siloam." This word means sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. His neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, "Isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg?" Some claimed that he was. Others said, "No, he only looks like him." But he himself insisted, "I am the man." "How then were your eyes opened?" they asked. He replied, "The man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and then I could see." "Where is this man?" they asked him. "I don't know," he said. Thank you.
Thanks, Etienne. Our talk today, as mentioned, is from Rory Shiner, but before he begins, I'd like to invite him up and ask him a few questions so we can all get to know him a little bit. Thank you for being here. And being a guest on campus, what has brought you here today?
So, I'm here to share with you from the Gospel of John, so I really want to kind of dig into that story. We're going to go a bit further than what was read, and I think it's a really exciting story, and I think it's going to help us to think about Jesus and what it means to know him. Did I understand the question right?
Yes, absolutely.
Because I was just thinking, I've got to live here with my son.
No, that's okay. No matter how you got here, we're glad. So is this your first time at a Bible talk?
No. So I came to my first ever Bible talk halfway through my first year at UWA, like in the 1990s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and it was in the Murdoch Lecture Theatre. Is that still? Yep, Murdoch Lecture Theatre. And it changed my life. So there you go. So I'm kind of like, I'm very invested in lunchtime Bible talks.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's great to hear. And lastly, what does sort of your week look like?
So I am a husband, father, and pastor. And so as a pastor, church, Sunday's a big day. That's very focused on church life. Monday to Thursday is running the church and doing all the things associated with that. We take Friday as a day off, and Saturday do a bunch of stuff, including getting the kids around to lacrosse. Did anyone play lacrosse or heard of lacrosse? Kind of like Quidditch. That's the family sport for some reason on Saturdays.
Absolutely.
And that's it. So yeah, we have four sons, and we all. Everyone's at home, and so it's kind of a big, boisterous household. Yeah,
that's great. All right, well, if I could invite you to
great
take it away.
Excellent, great to be with you. As I say, my name is Rory, and really great to be at UWA. So I did graduate from UWA, and more to the point, had my life changed in a lunchtime Bible talk at UWA. So it kind of feels very significant for me to be here. On Saturday, I think as Trent mentioned, we're going to be giving a bunch of students from across Perth have hired the Octagon Lecture Theatre, and we're going to be doing a whole bunch of stuff, including a talk that I'm going to be giving, and some other kind of testimonies and musical items and so on. The whole night will be geared toward, moving the needle on Perth and Jesus. So the whole night, the purpose of it, the reason for the gamble and the expense and all that, is that the people who have organised it want to see the position of Perth and God change for people to come to know God in Jesus. So I wanted to think with you about that as we start, and to think, if it was your assignment to change the story on God and Perth, if you want to, now, you don't have to be a Christian to do this thought experiment. It's just kind of working out what you would do. But if the assignment was, I want Perth to be a place where God is more widely known, where Christ is more widely revered, where more people know God through him, what would you do? And I'm going to give you three options. So the first one, but you only get to choose one of them. The first one is a debate. And because we're imagining this, you can choose whoever you want. So think of the most prestigious kind of exemplar of the atheist position in the world. Is that still Richard Dawkins? Is it Sam Harris? Stephen Fry? Do you think it's someone that you think, oh, they will be the most articulate, intelligent kind of, kind of combatant for the atheist side? And you put them up, hire the biggest place, maybe it's Octagon, maybe it's the entertainment centre or whatever, and you put them up against, I think, Trent would be great. So he's representing Christians, and it's, you know, do you want Stephen Fry or Richard Dawkins? Does it matter to you? Okay, let's put up Richard, and he's up there, and they have, you know, back and forth, and Richard Dawkins does his stuff about God and science and their mutual incompatibility, and a whole bunch of stuff about crazy stuff in the Old Testament and that, and then Trent gets up and says, oh, God and science works like this, and the Old Testament is to be understood this way and so on. And imagine, for the purpose of the exercise, by the end of it, Richard Dawkins is like, Trent, dude, this is embarrassing, but you've got me. Like, I just hadn't thought about it the way you've thought about it. That's actually a really compelling account of the Christian faith, and what must I do to be saved? So that's your first option on moving the needle for God and Perth. The second one I offer you is a budget is no obstacle advertising campaign. So you don't get the debate, but in exchange you get the best advertisers in the world with an unlimited budget to make God known in Perth. I feel like that one, maybe that's not the most attractive one, but I want to commend it to you because it's got, we live in an era where never before in the history of the world has as much research and as much kind of scientific evaluation gone into how you persuade people to want certain products or things. Like, it's unbelievable. We're the golden era of that, right down to the font you should use, the colours that are more likely to make you want something or not want something. So money's no obstacle. You can choose the best people in the world to present the most sophisticated, maybe celebrity-led, maybe artistically-driven advertising campaign. So that's the second one. The third one is an incontrovertible public miracle. So a thing that happens in Perth that is undeniably a supernatural action. Now, this one I'm offering to you, you don't get the other two if you choose this one. With this one, I'm not talking about like, oh, my back was really sore and my grandma prayed and I think it's slightly less sore, that kind of like, maybe not, who really knows? It's like a proper miracle that you can't deny. So you can think of your own one. The one I thought of was someone walks out, you're gathered down on the foreshore and someone walks, they're all gathered there, and someone walks onto the water in the Swan River. Just a normal human being just walking along the water out into the middle of the Swan River. And then you even think, oh, Swan River's quite shallow, or it could be a thing. But then all the fish in the Swan River spell the words God is real kind of underneath him. So they're your choices for moving the needle in Perth. Debate with a world-leading atheist. Advertising campaign without a budget limit. Or an incontrovertible, definitely happened, public miracle. Now, the reason I wanted you to think about that is two things. Firstly, just because that's kind of the zone we're in the Meet Jesus campaign, got this big thing happening on Saturday night, and so it's interesting to think about what we're doing and whether it's the right input to change the experience of Perth and God. But I raise it also because I think a question like that is sort of at the heart of the passage and the story that was just read to us, this story of the healing of a blind man by Jesus in the Gospel of John chapter 9. Now, if you can see that in a Bible or on a device, that'll help you as you follow through. John chapter 9 is a chapter really about evidence and persuasion, about what it is for people to go toward God in repentance and faith, and what the obstacles are to people making that journey. So let's have a look at it together. John chapter 9. And we're beginning in John chapter 9. There's a little bit of background in John chapter 8. I think this is significant. It's the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, you don't need to know too much about that, except you need to know that one of the features of the Feast of Tabernacles is that Jewish people would come into Jerusalem, and part of the tradition was that you would light big menorahs, like big candles, at the end of the day, massive ones in the temple and small ones in homes. And so one of the features of the festival that means Jesus is in Jerusalem is that the city of Jerusalem becomes the city of lights. Like, there's just candles and menorahs and stuff everywhere. It's kind of a light, L-I-G-H-T, light festival that Jesus is part of. And in chapter 8, which is very on brand for Jesus, he says in Jerusalem at the festival, "I am the light of the world." So if you don't know that, not from a Jewish background, which I'm not, you can miss it. It's worth knowing that Jesus is in the middle of a festival that involves these big menorahs, the city on a hill, you know, Jerusalem thing. And he says, "I am the light of the world." And by the end of chapter 8, for a story too long to go into, they want to kill him. And so he's saying this stuff. There's this whole interaction with the religious establishment. It goes very badly. And he kind of has to escape. He has to disappear or else he's going to get killed. So that's the context in chapter 8. Chapter 9, verse 1. "And as he went along, he saw a man blind from birth." So I think that's significant, right? We've just come out of this festival of light, where Jesus says he's the light of the world, and as Jesus is going incognito, avoiding his enemies, he meets a blind man, a man who has been blind from birth. That is a man who has no idea even what light is. It's interesting, the author, John, wants you to know that this guy has never seen a menorah, never seen a candle, never seen his mum's face. Never seen a smile or a sunrise or a sunset. He's blind. I understand in most cases blindness happens later in life. Very rare, but does happen for someone to be blind from birth, having never seen light. That's this guy's situation. And the disciples see him, the disciples with Jesus, and they say, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" And that's, I think, just a really worth putting a pin in that. It's a very interesting reaction to someone being born blind. It's not a thing that would occur to many of us, but in the kind of thought form of the disciples, that's a kind of legitimate question. They believe, as Christians also believe, that God made the world originally without sin and therefore without suffering. Or to put it the other way around, suffering comes as a result of sin. So a world without the rebellion of the angels and the humans would be a world without suffering, because we rebelled, because we sinned, we also have suffering. So there is a connection. And for the disciples, it's kind of right to make the connection. There wouldn't be blindness in a world without sin, but they're wrong in the limit of their options. Now, because you can have a direct correlation between sin and suffering, right? So you get drunk, getting drunk is a sin, and then you have a hangover, and that's like a direct result of that activity. Or you're mean to your friends, you're an unreliable person, and so you have no friends. That's a suffering as a result of sin, and it's a kind of, it correlates, right? Makes sense. There's other kinds of suffering that are a indirect result of sin. So our law courts do this, where our law courts, there's no direct correlation between stealing something from your house and being put in a small room, but our law courts put you in a small room, that is in jail, to bring about a kind of consequence for a thing that's wrong. And the Bible also says that God, to all of us in the age to come, and to some of us sometimes in this life, experience his judgment in that kind of direct cause and effect relationship. But the Bible has other categories that the disciples don't seem to bring out. For example, the Bible has the category of the innocent sufferer. of the person who's suffering, where they're a victim, not a perpetrator, where sin has happened to them, where their suffering is an experience beyond their control, and not, at least in that instance, of their deserving. And the Bible also has the category, if I can use a non-biblical term, of the successful jerk. The Bible is regularly aware of this person who sins all the time, whose life should have really terrible outcomes, but you look at it, actually, they're doing just fine. They're wealthy, they're prosperous, everything seems to be going well for them in a way that just seems not fair. The disciples had this kind of narrow category for the man born blind, and Jesus says in this case it is they're wrong on that account. Neither this man, I'll see if I've got these signs up here, neither this man or his neighbours, neither this man or his parents had sinned, but this has happened so that the works of God may be displayed in him. So that's the category that Jesus puts the blind man in, and then he gets about and does his work. And Jesus does some work. He spits, kind of weird, into the ground. He makes mud with the spit, and then he puts the spit across the guy's eyes, making a kind of a cake across his eyes, and then says, go and wash in the pool of Siloam. And he goes and he washes, and in the washing, he sees. Now, you've got the mud and the spit, and I just straight out confession, not 100% sure what to do with that. There are, if you want to have an idle afternoon, especially if you've got exams, when anything other than studying for exams feels attractive, you can do a deep dive on the internet and find out all the theories on why Jesus makes mud. There's even some theories on how he was able to generate that much, enough saliva to do the mud and all that sort of thing. You can have a deep dive on an idle afternoon. I'm not sure why he does it, but notice the result. The guy can see. Maybe you've got a better imagination than me. I essentially can't imagine what it would be like to see having never seen before. I tried to think about it, like maybe you can do this. Could you imagine describing a new primary colour to someone who didn't know about that colour? Like you've gone to Mars and there's a colour there that we primary colour there we don't have here. How would you describe it? Or could you describe the colour green to a friend who's never seen the colour green through colour blindness or something? Could you describe light to someone who's never seen light before? That's this guy's situation. He can see. He's never seen colour or light before, and suddenly the whole world opens up to him. The whole world opens up to him, and so you think, oh, this is amazing. This is going to be like one of those clips on YouTube where people can see through surgical procedures, and it'll just be like soaring, you know, kind of violins and so on as he comes through. But instead of sparking a celebration, his healing sparks a controversy. You heal one guy once and suddenly everyone starts losing their mind. That's what happens here. He's healed. And first thing, which I think maybe is reasonable, first of all, people are just kind of sceptical that it's happened. It's just not a thing. There's no Old Testament instance of a blind person coming, being given sight. And again, here everyone's like, this is very unusual. So they start postulating theories. Did it actually happen? Was he actually a from birth blind guy? Verse 8. They say, is this the guy who used to sit and beg? Some say yes, some say no. Some people say it's just a guy that looked like that guy that used to sit there and beg. Now, the guy thinks it's him. So the guy to whom it happened says, I am the guy. So he's on team him. He thinks it happened to him. And having kind of settled the argument by saying, yeah, look, it really is me. Really couldn't see. I really can. They ask, how then were your eyes opened? Sorry, I haven't got that one up there. How then were your eyes opened? And he says, it was Jesus. Now, there's this controversy, like, how did it happen? Now everyone establishes that it happened, and so the question becomes, who did it? Like, who's the person that can pull off the healing of the blind, and what sense are we supposed to make of that person? Weirdly, for the Gospel of John, Jesus himself goes missing for almost the rest of the story. if you're familiar with John's gospel, that's really strange. Jesus is like in camera all the time. And suddenly for this story, until the end, he's nowhere to be seen. So for a whole chapter in John's gospel, you're not seeing Jesus. You're hearing words about Jesus, and you're hearing people prosecute a case about Jesus, trying to work out who on earth he is. And in verse 14, you get this big reveal, this bit of information that's been held from us until this point. Verse 14, now the day on which Jesus made the mud and opened the man's eyes was a Sabbath. Ba-ba-bum. That's the reveal. The thing you didn't know the whole way through is that Jesus was making mud. I think that's the significant. Well, that's the import, right? If he just said be healed, be healed, that'd be fine. He made mud, kind of like making concrete or whatever, to work. And Jesus worked on the Sabbath. And now we've got a real controversy. So they take them to the Pharisees. That's who they go to. There's all this group. Notice the Pharisees aren't really in the story yet. The Pharisees are the reliable religious leaders, the ones that you would go to for some spiritual clarity. So there's confusion, first of all, over whether the healing happened, then who this guy is, then who's the guy that healed him. Now they've marshalled those facts together. They go to the Pharisees because they want some clarity. They want some spiritual kind of insight on what sense to make of the fact that this guy has had his eyes opened on the Sabbath by this guy that they don't really know. So verse 17, they start to interrogate the man himself. This is the Pharisees now. They say to him, what have you to say about him? That is about Jesus. It was he who opened your eyes. And this man kind of, remember, this is the uneducated beggar. He says he is a prophet. That is, if you ask the guy who did it, they're going to say, he says, prophet, that would be my guess. I think he's a prophet, which is, I think, not a bad guess. But it doesn't go down well with the Pharisees. In verse 19, at the conclusion of that, they say, this makes no sense, so they send for the parents, and they say to the parents in verse 19, is this your son? Is this the one that was born blind? How is it that he can now see? They ask him that, and the parents say, yeah, it is. So he was blind, and he can now see, so we can verify the story. But they don't want to say much more than that. And the reason's given in verse 22, and I think we've got that there, verse 22, they don't want to say that because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders who had already decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. I think one of the things that any kind of mature human being has to come to terms with is that we're all, to a greater or lesser extent, motivated by what philosophers call motivated reasoning. So we like to think that we're just evidence-based creatures, that we just, you know, whatever the evidence is, wherever it's going to lead, that's where I'm going to go. But it turns out that as humans, we're just not like that. The Pharisees look at Jesus, and they are the religious establishment, and it is troubling to them to think that someone who is not from their number, who they didn't educate, who they didn't train, it seems like God is with him. And what does that mean about them? So they've got a dog in the fight. And then the parents, who kind of, you know, maybe they could have been a bit more loyal to their son, but they're aware of the village. They're asking the question that actually lots of us ask to a much greater degree than we like to admit. When we're working out what we believe, we're often not just asking, is it true, but is it acceptable to the people that I spend my life with? What happens to my social standing if I stand up and say, I believe X, Y, and Z? And here the parents are doing the calculations, and they're aware that anyone who says that Jesus is the Messiah gets kicked out of the synagogue, and they're looking at their community and they're looking at their son, and they, as the evidence stacks up, they're just like, I don't know, I don't want to say. I don't really know what's going on. So they come back to the guy a second time in verse 24, and they ask him, and they say, give glory to God by telling the truth. We know that this man is a sinner. It's like a hilarious leading the witness situation where it's like they're taking the guy aside and saying, hey, just to come back to your previous testimony, when you said prophet, would another word for that be sinner? And the guy who's like this kind of no-name character in the Bible, we don't know his name, he doesn't come up again, but suddenly this huge personality emerges and he starts having it in with these guys. He says, whether he's a sinner or not, I don't know. The one thing I know is that I was blind and now I can see. This guy, the blind guy, is the one who's most willing to be led by the evidence. He's the one who's saying, listen, you've got a theory that he can't possibly be a prophet of God. I don't know, but I do know that I used to be blind and now I can see. And he says to them, do you want to become his disciples? It's kind of this cheeky little moment where he says, do you want to follow Jesus? They say, no, we're the disciples of Moses. We don't know where this guy came from. And the blind guy, verse 30, says, now this is remarkable. The blind guy kind of becomes the prosecutor now. He stops being the witness, becomes a prosecutor. He says, this is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God doesn't listen to sinners. He listens to the godly person who does his will. No one ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. The guy is an uneducated, formerly blind beggar. Theologically, I'm going with maybe an 8 out of 10, 8.5. Like, is that an HD? It's good, right? Like, surely you're giving that a good mark. Because he's thinking it through, and he's thinking, I know that I used to be blind from birth, now I can see. And he's working out what he can remember from synagogue, and he's saying, doesn't really sound like a Satan thing to bring sight to the blind. And it seems like, on the face of it, unlikely that God would be listening to a sinner, listening to someone, you know, who's... But he seems to be listening to this guy. And so the blind guy is the guy who can see most clearly. It's the blind guy who's doing the best theology, who's got the best understanding of the Bible, and he's doing the best work with the evidence. And so they do what kind of every desperate person does when you realise you've lost the argument. They go ad hominem and just start attacking the guy. They say to him in verse 34, you were steeped in sin and birth. How dare you lecture us? And with that, the whole story kind of nearly, apart from one more thing, comes to an end. We'll come back to the story, one more thing in the story as it finishes. But I just wanted, as we wrap it up together, we'll have a bit of time for questions. What is the story about? I think often with the Gospels, we think that the Gospel stories are just someone writing down, just recording things as they happen. And certainly I do think they happen, and someone recorded it. But we know that in John's Gospel, he had a huge amount of material to work from, and he chose this story. He thought, this one matters. What does he want us to see here? And I think the clue's there in verse 39. Jesus comes back into the story, and he says, for judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind. I think it's a story about the dynamics of sight and blindness, of seeing and not seeing Jesus. A little quadrilateral, I think this is how the story works. We begin with a guy who's spiritually and physically blind. He literally hasn't ever seen anything, and he certainly has not seen or understood the person of Jesus. In the story, he's given physical sight, but he's still spiritually blind. He says Jesus is a prophet, which I think, again, if you're giving marks, I think that's a 4 out of 10. Like, it's not bad. Sort of in the right direction. It's certainly not a complete answer to who Jesus is. But by the end of the story, he who has been given physical sight has also been given spiritual sight. But then you've got this other dynamic where you have the Pharisees who begin the story as those to whom you would go if you wanted spiritual clarity. Everyone in the story comes to the Pharisees and said, we don't know what's going on. Let's defer to our betters. Let's talk to these guys because they'll know what's going on. They'll be able to see what we can't see. But over the course of the story, in their interaction with Jesus, they end up spiritually blind. But by the end of the story, the roles are completely reversed into who can and who can't see the truth of Jesus. So on Saturday night, what we're going to do, we're going to get a bunch of people together, share with Jesus. We want the needle to move dramatically in people's lives so that they will, if we put it in these terms, open their eyes and see Jesus. That's what we want to happen all the time, and it's particularly where a lot of time and energy is going on Saturday night. Well, of those three that I gave you at the beginning, which one do you think would work? I like them all. Happy to do all three. The first one, I think the Christian faith does have content that needs to be reasoned out. That it's worth thinking these things through, that it's worth thinking through the challenges to the Christian faith at their best and answering them the best that we can. Would that change Perth? I don't know. Not to judge anyone, but I do notice that whenever I've been to debates, and I quite like debates, people seem to leave with the same opinion that they came in with. That we've got this ability, a bit like the Pharisees, of filtering everything through our priors and making it fit. And so, you know, I don't know if you watch American politics, but, you know, if you're on Team Trump, he can do no wrong. If you're on anti-Team Trump, then the Democrats can do no wrong. And it depends on who you're listening to as to whether the rally had 100,000 people at it or like two people at it. People seem to see what they want to see, right? Advertising campaign, you know, let's do it well. I like the shirts, good font, nice colour, it kind of works. Feels like advertising is addressing us at a reasonably shallow level, like not nothing, right? But does it really change Perth? Or the miracle? Just so you know, that's the one I chose. Thought that'd be sick. Still would. If someone could do that this afternoon, I would be down there. I'd be bang up for watching that. Would it change Perth? I'm gonna say a soft no. Based on two things. Partly, like every time a big public miracle happens in the Bible, it seems to spark as much controversy as it does faith. Like these guys, notice in this story, no one's disputing that it happened. Once they establish that it's happened, and now they're just working out whether Jesus is run by Satan or run by God, that they apply their priors even to the miracle. And I kind of think that's what would happen, right? You'd go down there, someone walks onto the water, the fish all spell God is real. And I think for a few weeks we're like, this is amazing, and maybe the churches get a bump and the people are more open to religious questions. And then I think the second round of press comes through of like, you know, that it was done with some sort of AI, CGI type situation, that in a universe as old as ours, at some point, just like monkeys are eventually going to write Hamlet, the fish were always going to spell God is real at some stage, and it just happened to be at the point where the guy was fake walking on the water or whatever. I think after a while, we just go back to the point where it's like, oh, that was weird. You see, Jesus is in the business of breaking into our world and not just giving evidence that we think, oh, that's quite good, or miracles that we think, oh, that's really impressive, or an advertising campaign that's very compelling. He's come into our world because we've got a problem as he says in John chapter 1, light has come into the world, but humans love the darkness because their deeds were evil. See, we've all got a prior. That in our rebellion against God, we're actually kind of fans of being away from God. It was convenient for us to hide from him. Is light a good or a bad thing? Kind of depends on what you're up to. If you try to find your keys, you want light. If you try to rob someone's house, you want it to be as dark as possible. Light's kind of a problem then. And so one of the things that we're praying for on Saturday, one of the things that we're working for in the Christian Union and our churches and so on week by week, and one of the things that I pray will happen today, is that God, who gives us evidence and has performed miracles and comes to us in compelling ways, will do the thing that only he can do in making spiritually blind people awake and able to see the glory of God in the face of Jesus.